They can be a great people, Kalo. They wish to be. They only lack the light to show the way. For this reason, above all this reason, their capacity for good. I have sent them you. My only son.
My spider senses are starting to tingle.
Just hang on to your lariat.
Wonder what kind of a scene I'm getting into.
And welcome to issue 53 of Behind the Panels, the comic book podcast that's all new, all different, and a little bit uncanny. I'm Richard Gray.
And I'm David McVeigh.
David, we've just had an awesome morning because we've spoken to Chris Claremont, but in this issue, we'll look at Dark Horse's new adaptation of the original Star Wars scripts and introduce our all-new Compact News headline segment. We tease our exclusive interview with the legendary Chris Claremont before delving into our kick-ass pick of the week, his classic Uncanny X-Men, The Phoenix Saga, Proteus Saga, Dark Phoenix Saga.
I think quite possibly, easy to say, the longest comic run we've ever done.
But of course, we're going to do that every week for you because this is Behind the Panels.
No place to hide, no place to run, no place to run. The mutant age has now begun.
That was the theme song to the unaired 1989 Pride of the X-Men pilot, which we played, of course, today in honour of our interview with Chris Claremont, and indeed the massive run of Uncanny X-Men that we're doing. That unaired pilot will feature again in a few moments in our vintage clip of the week, but it's a little bit hilarious. But of course, we did speak to Chris Claremont today. He was very generous with his time. We spent just over an hour talking to him.
I gotta say, the man was so giving with his time and sharp as a tack. I mean, we went into this interview worried about, you know, saying, oh, let's not be too comic book guy. We can't sit there and go, in an issue 94, you know, you did this. But no, he was doing it to us.
Yeah, he was like, he said, let me see, that was in issue 98. No. Correct me, it was 99. You know? you hear all that anyway on, if you go to behindthepanels.net, should be out in the next few days. You'll also find that on the regular podcast stream if you subscribe through iTunes.
And just to give you a little bit of a preview, it sounds a little bit like this. Speaking of unstoppable, though, I got a very quick question, which was that the Phoenix character that you created was a phenomenal character and a huge kick in the pants for the X-Men because it was a whole new level of power that the X-Men hadn't really had up until that point. Was it always your intention from the time you created her to have her lose control and die, or were you ever tempted to keep her as an ongoing character without making her turn evil, just keep her on as basically a powerful woman?
Well, the original idea when we got... No, we never thought she was going to die.
Oh, okay.
Well, you don't kill characters. Like, Jean's the second half of the second oldest romantic relationship in Marvel Comics. Mm. You're not going to... Yeah, what are you going to do, kill off Reed Richards?
What did I tell you? The man is a legend.
Awesome. So if you want to hear all the whole hour of it, check out the website. Now, but of course, despite the fact we've had an awesome morning already, we're going to make it even more awesome.
It can't get any more awesome.
David, I beg to differ because I'm going to take us back in time with a little bit of our vintage clip of the week.
As for me, I have the ability to see into people's minds.
Their minds?
Oh, don't worry, child. I don't use my gift recklessly. I think you'll find my X-Men a very pleasant group once you get to know them, Miss Pride. Scott?
I have someone up here I'd like you all to meet.
Sure thing, Professor.
Ah, Fräulein, what a lovely vision you are. Please allow me.
Professor?
Kitty, you're freezing.
I guess I phased through the computer.
She has the power to walk through solid objects, a power known as phasing.
Kate!
It is good, little one. Colossus like rain.
Fräulein, you left before I could properly welcome you.
Welcome her? Wait, she's not joining the X-Men, is she? She's just a kid.
Wolverine, can't you see the girl is scared? Don't you remember what it was like when you first discovered you were a mutant?
Hey, back off! Just don't want to have to witness some little...
What's that?
Red alarm. It's a mutant alert. Our training session's over. We're needed.
Let's go!
Okay, I think I know why the series failed, because both Colossus and Nightcrawler sound like child molesters.
And Wolverine was Australian for some reason.
For some odd reason, he was Australian.
Well, actually, there's a reason behind that, because apparently, it was the pride of the X-Men unaired pilot, unaired for very good reason. It was originally broadcast, I think, in 1989. Well, I think the it may have actually been aired, but the series was never picked up. That episode was more or less based on, it was sort of influenced by 129 to 139, so which is where we're talking about this week as well.
Yeah.
But apparently the whole thing about Wolverine being Australian was that he speaks with an Australian accent despite being Canadian in the comics, as we all know Wolverine's Canadian, because apparently someone misread... him in the script. Wolverine calls the traditionally Australian character Pyro a dingo. In the final version, however, Wolverine calls Toad a dingo rather than Pyro, and this apparently caused an error to make him think that was Wolverine was supposed to be speaking with an Australian accent.
And nobody picked up on this?
Well, they ended up, they said, I was forced to use the actor said, I was forced to use the Australian version. Which coincidentally foreshadowed the casting of Australian actor Hugh Jackman in the X-Men film, because of all the Australian stuff that was popular at the time. Right. Mad Max films, Crocodile Dundee, etc. So a very odd little era of the X-Men comics.
There. Yeah, I also love the fact that when she phases, it sounds like she's standing on a frying pan crackling. It's like, that's not the phasing I remember.
Yeah, my Fräulein.
Yeah, my Fräulein.
Well, of course, this is from a very classic run. We were talking about a very, very large run of X-Men comics today, and as you'll hear in the interview with Chris Claremont, we only barely kind of scratched the surface of this thing.
But it is fair to note that the 60-odd issues that we're doing today, and yes, we know it's a very long, but we did give you 3 weeks to read this. So,
but and really, some people have had 40 years to read them.
Well, that's true. And this is probably the definitive retelling of the X-Men to the point where this is what established everything to come.
Absolutely. And I'm looking forward to cracking that open. But for now, let's look at something a little bit more recent in what we've been reading.
Where? It's like we got ourselves a reader. Read between the lines, bitch.
Which is exactly what we've done this week. David, there's only a couple I want to talk about this week. One of the main ones, which we were all very excited about, was Thanos Rising.
Which I haven't had a chance to read yet, so tell me.
Well, I've put up a review. If you've already been to behindthepanels.net...
I never read my own site. Are you
kidding? No, of course not. you would have seen that there is a little review up for there. I didn't particularly like this book.
Oh, dear.
Thanos, I think, is one of those characters that you have to do very well, and he has been done very well. My touchstone for this is that Jim Starlin series from a few years back, just the one that just predated Annihilation, that 12-issue maxi
Thanos
series. And it doesn't go into his past, but it gives you a sense that he is a flawed villain.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I really liked about it. This is weird. This goes all the way back to his birth, where he's born on Titan. Everyone else is these perfect, genetically perfect people. He's born as this gnarled purple creature, which instantly starts him off in the bad foot. And then he has this really sort of like Hayden Christensen-esque adolescence where he's like, you know, Luke Skywalker from Attack of the Clones and all pouty and stuff. He ticks all the right boxes. He's like social outcast. He's physically different. He's nerdy. He's got an unhealthy fascination with sketching dead things, you know? And he's got this woman, this girl who's kind of fascinated with him, who's kind of looming over him. I suspect that she might be like a death avatar kind of figure. And this is early fascination with death. And sort of builds up from there. It's just such a weird thing.
Who wrote this?
This was written by Jonathan Hickman, which is the weird thing. Because he's normally quite good. But this is almost... I've started referring to this as Thanos and Friends in Titan Adventures. Because it kind of... it reads like a Saturday morning cartoon. There's even a line, and I'm quoting here. There's his girls talking. This is Titan. Everyone is cute. Cute is boring. You're boring. Why is his face all purple? Listen to you. You want to kiss him, don't you? Do you want to kiss him, don't you? I mean, this is the level that Thanos...
don't my boobs look good in this.
I know. And this is the level that this book is at. So... I'm a bit disappointed this is where it's starting, because normally these miniseries...
This should have been handled by Bendis. It really should have
it
been.
It should. Like, normally these miniseries punch in hard and then sort of waver off in the middle and then finish. I'm hoping this finishes strong, because this is Thanos we're talking about.
And this is also leading into our new cosmic universe, which so far has been so strong.
And they're really, like, within the pages of this, they're actually saying this is part... Because it starts off, the first couple of pages, are Thanos returning home to Titan.
Right.
So it's set now and then in flashback as well. So... we know that this is going to tie directly into the Marvel Cosmic Universe.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and they're selling it as a tentpole, so it has to be good. Sadly, it didn't start off that well. I want to talk about Walking Dead quickly, but David, what have you been reading?
Just very quickly, I just want to throw out, I haven't read a whole lot this week because, well, no, that's not true. I've been reading a whole lot, but it's all been X-Men because we've been in this X-Men craze.
Too. Yeah.
But I just wanted to throw in there, we all know that I'm a bit obsessed by Power Girl. I admit it, I've got a problem. But but the latest World's Finest almost made me break into a cold sweat and keel over because the front cover is her kissing Mr. Terrific.
Oh, well, these are all these WTF covers that they put out.
Yeah, and I went, no, don't do this. Right? What the hell? But it's okay. I'm here to report spoilers, people. I'm here to report it's a dream.
Oh,
it's okay.
Thank God.
It's okay.
That sounds like a nightmare.
Well, a bit of a nightmare, yeah. So, but, you know, I got to just say really quickly that they got to get her into her original costume and rework this series because World's Finest is sinking fast.
Yeah.
It is. It started off, well, I was kind of interested in it, and it's sinking fast.
It's not isolated to World's Finest as far as
these. Well, that's true.
David, before we move on from this section, I just want to talk about Walking Dead finished up last week.
Yes.
And
that people, there's no spoilers here. Okay. Not for Walking Dead. We know.
We know, yeah. But, you know, it ended on a point that I didn't expect, because in a lot of ways, season 3 of this show has taken it in direction so far away from the comic now that even those of us who've read the 110 issues or whatever we're up to have no idea where it's going.
No, it's true.
Which is good.
It's taken on a life of its own.
But Dave Longo, my good friend from DamnGoodCup.com, who's a regular guest on the show, said that he wasn't happy with the way that this series has been handled. He thinks they've ruined the whole prison governor saga, and he could be right.
I actually agree with him. I think if you are looking at it as a straight adaptation of the comic book, then yes, absolutely.
There's so much they could have done with it they didn't.
Yeah. And look, it's no hidden thing here on Geek Actually, on Film Actually, on the Talking Dead cast, which I was a guest on a couple of times. I many, many times talked about the fact that I really didn't like the direction that the TV series has gone in, because I am such a fan of the comic book that I wanted it to be an adaptation of the comic book. But that being said...
Yeah.
I've actually really enjoyed season 3.
It's been good television, because let me just tell you, I sit in behind two people at work, neither of whom are remotely comic book fans, come in every Wednesday morning, because it screens on a Tuesday night here in Australia, come in every Wednesday morning, and they're like, my God, did you see last night's episode? What's going to read the comics? I want to know what's happening next. Richard, you've read the comics. I said, look, yeah, you're on your own here. I've got no idea. And they said, we don't want to know, but we want to know. And so it's... it is compelling. It is a crossover hit, much like Game of Thrones. It's been one of those shows that's helped both audiences come to it. So,
look, I've really enjoyed season 3, and I really enjoy what they have done in season 3. I think if you're looking for an adaptation of the comic book, steer well and truly clear of it, because it's going to disappoint you, because it's not the comic book. It's gone off in its own direction. But you know what? As a series on its own, if you divorce yourself from the comic book, it's a damn good piece of television.
We will do a Walking Dead special at some stage in the future. And we'll also do an Arrow special, because that's finishing up soon.
The Walking
Dead
special will be actually probably in the next couple of weeks. We've got to do it while the iron is hot, so to speak.
Absolutely. But for all the latest reviews, go to behindthepanels.net. Just click on reviews in the top bar and you can find all of our latest there. If you can also find us now on comicbookroundup.com, where you can compare what critics say from all over the web. Great little website.
Cool stuff.
They're plugging us, so we plug them. But for now... let's go into, for the first time, our new look news format.
What a scoop!
What we're going to do is we're going to concentrate on one story for this news section, and then we're going to run through some of the headlines, just because you can find the rest of the stuff on our website, because we're keeping that up to date. Now, the big news that broke, well, there's a lot of big news that broke this week, but one of the stories I wanted to talk about was Lucasfilm and Dark Horse announcing that they'll be releasing The Star Wars. What this is actually the adaptations of George Lucas's original screenplays and outlines to Star Wars back when it was Luke Starkiller.
That's right, Luke Starkiller, The Adventures of Luke Starkiller and the Journal of the Wills, I believe it was called.
Yes, that's right.
So it'll be very interesting to see what he does with this, or what Dark Horse does with this, because I wasn't even aware that full scripts existed for this. So it's going to be very interesting to see if they're creating this on the fly, or how much of this is based on Lucas's work. I'm excited.
Well, as they say here, it's they released this on April 1st, and they said, no, it's not an April Fool's prank.
Bad day to release a big story.
I know, exactly. And it's like, it must be terrible being an editor on that day, trying to work out fact from fiction. And it's like, you know, it was written 3 years before his 1977 film. It's the story of Jedi Anakin Starkiller and General Luke Skywalker, an alien named Han Solo, and evil Sith Knights.
It sounds awesome.
Yeah. The screenplay was titled The Star Wars. And the longtime Star Wars editor, Randy Sadly, says, I'm not sure where I first read about the Star Wars. It was years ago, but the idea of Luke Skywalker being an older Jedi general and Han Solo being a six-foot-tall lizard turned my Star Wars fan brain on its side. So I can't wait to read it, because it is kind of almost reading a Star Wars Elseworlds, but no, it's the original version.
It's the original. It's the one that the studios looked at and went, no.
it's Star Wars Earth 2.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm quite keen. We should also very quickly mention, we won't go into detail, you can read about it on behindthepanels.net. This morning it broke.
Yes.
Captain America the Winter Soldier went into production, and the first still came out. And boy, that cast list is awesome.
It's pretty much an Avengers sequel.
Yeah, it pretty much is. I mean, we knew about Falcon, we knew about, you know, a bunch of them, but suddenly in this cast list we also have Nick Fury, we also have Scarlett Johansson returning as Black Widow. We have Hayley Atwell finally listed in credits as Peggy Carter, so we're assuming flashbacks. I'm very excited.
Oh, look, I can't be more excited about that upcoming Marvel films. That's just the one thing that gets me up in the morning.
And the point that we made this morning, which was, that means that Marvel now actually has three films in production simultaneously, which has never happened before.
And as you said, that's that Disney money.
That's that Disney money, absolutely.
Disney coin. Now we're going to head into some news headlines, so I can actually play this button. That's right, David.
Are we the Onion all of a sudden?
So, this week's news headlines. You should look out for a Justice League crossover in July as the Trinity War finally starts at DC Comics. The crossover event runs for 6 issues over 3 different Justice League comic books in July and August. Zoe Saldana's in talks for Gamora in Marvel's 2014 release, Guardians of the Galaxy.
I'm down with that.
Oh, yeah. S.H.I.E.L.D. is now called Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and J. August Richard, who played Gunn on Angel, joins in a secret role. Marvel unleashes Superior Spider-Month in July with a new series, Superior Spider-Foes of Spider-Man. That's hard to say.
Oh, God.
So it's actually Superior Foes of Spider-Man. Superior Carnage, Superior Spider-Man Team-Up, and, of course, the Shadowlands story arc in Superior Spider-Man. God, I wouldn't want to have a lisp in that.
No.
Marvel's Infinity will be a 6-issue limited series from Jonathan Hickman from August. Prepare for things to get cosmic in the next big event following the current event. And finally, on a little bit of sad news, legendary DC Comics artist and editor Carmine Infantino died this week. As an artist, he created the modern costume for The Flash, and he also co-created Barry Allen, Wally West, Barbara Gordon as Batgirl, Deadman, Black Canary, along with the idea of the multiverse in The Flash of Two Worlds. As an editorial director, he hired the likes of editor Dick Giordano, writer Denny O'Neill, artist Neil Adams, consulted on the first 2 Superman films, and initiated the first intercompany crossover in Superman versus The Amazing Spider-Man. He was 87. He will be missed.
Absolutely.
For all the latest news, head to behindthepanels.net and click on news.
Fantastic. I like this new segment.
We got through news about 25 minutes faster than we normally would and still covered about as much meaningful detail as we probably would in the previous format.
Send us feedback if you like the new format, or you want us to go back to the old format. Feedback at behindthepanels.net. We always love to know.
And speaking of feedback, David's about to fire up the girl from Ipanema, because we have a little bit of feedback and we also have a little bit of plugging.
hello, where's the girl from Ipanema? She's not playing. Why is she not playing? She's not playing, dude.
We'll go into the feedback.
You know what? By the miracle of post-production, I'm going to be adding it right about now.
Now, we had a little bit of feedback this week. Actually, our good friend Matt from Matt's Movie Reviews. Not Matt Kay, who's normally our Matt on this show. This is our other Matt. Matt from Matt's Movie Reviews actually tweeted me to say, hey, what's the best way to store away old comic books? It's actually something that's been plaguing me a bit because, David, you saw my room recently.
Yeah, I did recently.
Trying to store my books. Really, if you've got books and there's lying around, the main things you don't want to do is just pile them. You don't want to, because the thing about comics is that the staples will make the spines curl. So if you can bag and board them, if you want to preserve them, that's the best way to do them. You have to go along to a specialist comic book shop, get yourself some Mylar bags, some acid-free backing boards. Then you've got them, you got yourselves in a stiff backing so the comics won't fold. Ideally, you get yourself a box, either a long box or a short box. They sell them in most comic supplies. You can get them online now as well. And you know, they all sit up very nicely in that. I think Ryan was here. Ryan Huff from Geek of Oz was here a few weeks ago. Said he just likes the way they sit up in
yes.
the box.
Now, my question for you, though, is I was in King's Comics just yesterday. And on the wall, they've got all the different bag sizes. Mm-hmm. So you've got the old magazine style size, the modern. But where do you get the boards?
The boards are there as well. Sometimes they don't have them in stock, but they should have them in stock at the same place. Your bigger comic places will have them. With the different size bags, current size comics are smaller to the old Silver Age comics. I actually find the Silver Age bags really good for holding things like, well, obviously Silver Age comics, but also those prestige format ones, because they otherwise the bag actually pulls and they fold a little bit as it was. But also, you know, maybe think about, once you've found a good storage solution, storing them away. Putting them somewhere safe and dust-free and out of direct sunlight and a good temperature.
Because, and not in a place that has a lot of moisture.
Not in a place that has a lot of moisture, because with the rise of digital comics, you can go back and read all these old comics without, you know, creasing up your finely bagged and boarded ones. Also, make sure that you go back and check them every now and then. While we're here in our feedback section, we're going to give ourselves a bit of feedback and just plug our own wares. This is a really good opportunity for us to say we love bringing you free content every week. We love interviewing people like Chris Claremont. But everything costs us money. Set up, getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Storage,
all that sort of stuff. We'd like you to help us out by heading to behindthepanels.net, where you can buy merchandise. You can buy, you've seen the cartoon faces on our website and on the iTunes feed as well. You can find those faces on mugs, on t-shirts, and soon on a whole range of new products.
We'll be releasing iPhone covers, iPad covers. I'm even working on a wall clock at the moment, so that's going to be fun.
And you can get, it'll be our faces with things like behind the panels and little phrases like
great flaming arrows.
Or, but you won't hear things like
be a mewling quim.
No.
But you might hear something like
just hang on to your lariat.
Absolutely.
So do us a favor, go and support us by checking out our wares and maybe even buying one or two.
And once again, if there is a favorite quote that you've heard on this show that you think deserves to be on a t-shirt, send it in to us. We'll put it under consideration.
Absolutely. So for example, Chris Claremont, you're a legend.
That would go on a t-shirt. We may have to clear his name, though.
Yeah, yeah. We'll probably wear those t-shirts next time we go and see him.
Yeah. We love Chris.
I think we're the biggest Chris Claremont fan club in the world now.
We're a fan club of two.
Which is probably then a really good time to get into this week's Kick-Ass Pick of the Week.
Well, see how you like this.
What is it, Batman?
Whatever it is, it's awfully funny.
It's the pick of the week.
And I can honestly say this week there are some really funny things in this. So it's got some really funny stuff in the book.
It's an amazing run. For those of you who aren't familiar with this run, we'll play you a clip in a minute from actually Chris Claremont and Stan Lee talking about the birth of this run. But to put it in context, the X-Men weren't doing too well publishing-wise at the time, back in the late 60s, early 70s. And X-Men had actually, from issue 66 through to issue 93, had been reprints of the first 66 issues. The failing title was revived by Len Wein and Dave Cockrum with Giant Size X-Men number 1.
Which, interestingly enough, was actually on the most recent issue of Comic Book Men, the Kevin Smith series on AMC, and they just sold that for $550.
Wow,
And that was not bagged or boarded. That was just literally a loose comic. So this just shows you the power of the X-Men today.
Yeah, well, and that really, that one book that 80-page book, I think it was, changed what the modern X-Men look like and also changed the direction of the book entirely, so that when our man Chris Claremont and John Byrne took the book over over the course of the next, hundreds of issues. Like, I mean, he was on originally from issue 94 through to 279, I think it was.
Something like that, yeah.
And then he came back for runs later on, but it was a 17-year continuous run that also went off on sidebars like God Loves, Man Kills, The New Mutants, Excalibur, all those sorts of things. So we're really talking about someone who quite literally defined the X-Men.
To the point where the 90s cartoon series is pretty much solely based on his run. And the movies, X-Men 1 and 2 in particular, are very much based on that feeling of comic books. If not directly adapted, they are very much Claremont's X-Men.
I'm just going to play you a little bit of a clip. This is not from our interview. This is from the X-Men 2 DVD. There's a bonus feature on there called The Secret Origin of the X-Men or something along those lines, which is actually Chris Claremont and Stan Lee talking about that transition period and what it was like writing the X-Men in those days.
1963, 64, 65 was not the time that people were interested in reading The Adventures of Misfits.
Apparently, without Jack's artwork, some of the readers started slackening off, and therefore the sales slumped for a while.
The problem was our marketing was such that we didn't find out about the sales until the final numbers on the sales till 10 months after publication. By then, the decision had been made to kill the book. So we didn't know that it was actually going up until it was too late, which is why they brought it back as a reprint, to see if we could sustain the interest and then figure out what to do next. So then it became a matter of the right time, the right place, the right creative team, which in Len and Dave Cockrum, and then Dave Cockrum and me, thankfully, they found.
Chris Claremont took over, and somehow the stories became very complex. A lot more characters were introduced.
Not just somehow, Stan, very deliberately so, as we found out.
Yeah, and let's not beat around the bush. As much as I love Stan Lee, and I mean, the man is a legend, his writing was not deep.
Yeah, he was an amazing plotter.
Yeah.
He was a master of plotting.
He's like George Lucas. He was a good storyteller.
Yeah.
But his writing wasn't deep. Chris Claremont brought in depth.
And one of the things I was interested in doing a bit of research about Chris Claremont for the interview was that he was originally training to be an actor, like a lot of people that we've spoken about who were either training to be filmmakers, Brian Michael Bendis, Jeff Lemire, all these great writers, originally trained to do something else, but then found their talents being used elsewhere. He started his career as a gopher at Marvel, in fact. But he used his method acting as a way of working out the motivations of all these characters, which is why you instantly get these much deeper characters, with all of whom have their own backstory. With flaws and backstories and motivations that aren't just, we have to rescue the girl.
And in fact, it's funny, and we'll talk about this as we get into the book, but Cyclops actually now stands out a little bit as two-dimensional compared to these new X-Men who are surrounding him.
It really is. He is the old guard compared to the new guard. That's very much one of the tensions of this. Basically what happens is when giant-sized X-Men starts, and again, let's remember this was the first new X-Men story in about 5 years, Professor X is looking for a new team because his other team have gone...
They went missing.
And so he's looking for a new team to go and search for them, which he does. And they go off to the island of Krakoa. Which turns out to be a living island.
Which, interestingly enough, in the interview, Chris Claremont actually talks about the fact that he helped with the plotting.
Yes.
At the end of this to get rid of the island and how they defeat Krakoa. He was involved in that plotting. So he was involved in Giant Size X-Men right from that very beginning part.
And that you can see that going through, and that when he took over in 94, he got rid of the characters he didn't want. There's actually, he mentions the line at the end of, I think, Giant Size X-Men, where it's like 13 X-Men, what are we going
to
do with that?
Yeah, and he mentions in the interview, once again, I keep coming back to this, but he mentions the fact that he said that you look at it and go, those X-Men had their chance.
Yeah.
And they...
They didn't sell.
Their sales had slumped. So it was time for the new
guy. So basically, he keeps Cyclops as the leader, begins to sideline Professor X very heavily.
Very much so.
In fact, to the point where he ends up sending him into space throughout this run. Also, and so you introduce that your core X-Men team start to look a little bit more like what we've got now. You've got Wolverine. You've got Storm. You've got Colossus. You've got Nightcrawler.
Yep.
And Cyclops.
Yep.
Those five form the new X-Men team.
Don't forget Thunderbird.
Oh, and Thunderbird initially, but Claremont dispatches with him fairly quickly. So I suspect he was not one of Claremont's favorite characters.
Well, and quite frankly, I mean, I don't mean to make it sound like, you know, it sounds terrible because it's kind of like the black guy dies first, you know. But bottom line is Thunderbird was not a compelling character.
He's not a compelling character, and there was two reasons. He had two angry characters.
Yes.
Thunderbird was always angry at the man and the institution, and so was Wolverine.
Mm.
And for whatever reason, although I think Claremont seems to regret that decision to some extent in the interview, he kept Wolverine around.
Well, he liked his Wolverine. And it's something, we'll let you listen to the interview for more details, but basically, like a lot of us, he's a little bit disappointed in the direction Wolverine has taken.
And I think we can all agree on that.
Yeah, so and basically, his Wolverine, that early Wolverine, is a flawed character. Mm. He's secretive. You don't really know what his powers are. He's not invulnerable. He can get hurt. He actually mentions it several times. I could have bought the farm on that one, you know, and stuff like that. So it's like he wasn't this, for lack of a better word, immortal person that he's become, you know?
And while we're not mincing words, David, I think it's fair to say that As great as Claremont's writing is on this run, and as great as his overall arcs are, this is very much a product of its time.
Yes.
This is very much written in the 70s when it was very melodramatic in a lot of respects. There's a lot of writing in there. These are very dense comics, something you pointed out to me several times. But what it does, and this is a question David asked in the interview as well, the idea that there seems to be, although Claremont sort of downplays it and says not so much, the idea that there's this overarching storyline. Because he really took the attitude of rather than going, we're going to do a 5-issue arc, we're going to do a 6-issue arc, which is what you get now, it was kind of like, let's just keep telling the story.
It was a soap opera.
It was a soap opera on Earth and in space.
Yeah.
And you really get this. And out of this, we got things like the first part of this was the death and resurrection of Jean Grey as Phoenix, which really, in a lot of ways, defined the next 30, 40 issues.
And that really is the point where, I've got to say, from the moment that Jean Grey, I'm getting goosebumps even talking about it, from the moment Jean Grey bursts out of the water and makes that proclamation about Jean Grey is gone, basically, and I am Phoenix, I am light, I am forever, I am Phoenix, whatever it is she says, that is where this entire thing turns around.
Yeah.
Because those first, I don't know, what is it, 5 issues, 6 issues, whatever it is, it's kind of slow going. It's like we're forming a new team. And it feels
like
there's
a lot of arguments.
There's a lot of argument. We got Thunderbird dying, who we don't really care about, you know, and all this.
Which weighs heavily on Scott. Even though that it doesn't come up a lot later, Scott's worry about losing people, about letting
it's his,
people
because
die.
Of his, it's because of his underlying insecurity about being leader. And he feels that he let it down as a leader. And I think that's a really interesting arc. Because as two-dimensional as I always thought Cyclops was, there is certain elements in this series, and this particularly this 60-issue arc, where we have one of the greatest comic book romances ever.
Oh, full stop.
Full stop. Yep. I mean, forget Gwen Stacy. Forget Jean Grey, Scott Summers. This is Romeo and Juliet stuff. This is just, it's an amazing, amazing arc. Because it's tragic.
Because
of wasted time. Because of Scott being so stoic. Because he can't share his emotions. He loses so much time that by the time they finally proclaim this love for each other, she's gone.
Which you really get. There's a great flashback issue. There's an issue 138, which is, and this is spoilers and all people, this is the point where Jean dies. And we all
this
know.
Is a 40-year-old book guys. Yeah. So.
So where the point Jean dies, they do a book that basically could have saved us a lot of time, where they go back and look at everything from issue 1 through to issue 137. And Scott reflects on his time with her and thinks about how much time he wasted, thinks about all those moments and what she actually meant to him. But you also get his insecurities. You also get how much of an orphan, being an orphan, defined his emotional response to things. And it's a real tearjerker of an issue because you really, for the first time, get a sense of how much turmoil this guy is feeling constantly every time he goes out on a mission.
And what's really interesting about this, and we were just talking about this before the show, is it actually does set up in many ways a foundation for what Scott has become now. Because you suddenly...
In Avengers versus X-Men, certainly.
Yeah, because you suddenly go, he really is damaged.
Because when he gets that power in Avengers versus X-Men, it's suddenly he gets the Phoenix power, and suddenly he's not the little guy anymore. He's not the guy that's struggling to understand his responses. He can literally control reality. He can make the reality he
wants.
But
he's still insecure.
But he's still insecure about it.
Yeah.
So by the time you get to Uncanny X-Men, which is the current run of Uncanny X-Men, where he's going out trying to bring mutants back into the fold, give them a new family, you can see that character's come full circle in a lot of ways, but he's a lot more bitter now than he was.
Yeah.
Back in those days when he was effectively the Boy Scout of the Marvel U.
He was the low rent Captain America.
Yeah.
In the sense of being that Boy Scout, you know.
And he always felt like the low rent Captain America.
Yes, he did. He did. So. It was an extraordinary romance. And I think that the Jean Grey character, I mean, it's interesting because I actually went back and I looked at issue 1 to about, I think it was like 4 or 5. And I actually had to look at those early Stan Lee ones. And the X-Men was shallow. I mean, I can understand why this book didn't. I mean, in its day, it would have been like, oh, this is very different. But then it's just kind of same old, same old.
So there's a great scene in where Jean Grey's first introduced. Yeah, and it's like, oh, look, a redhead.
She got the body to match. You know? It's like, it's so 60s. And it's like, and it just doesn't quite work. And you kind of go, okay, this is not my X-Men.
No.
But then when Claremont took it and he basically said, what can we do with this? How can we make a dysfunctional team to start with? Mm-hmm. And even Professor X keeps saying all the way through it, he's going, I can't reestablish my psychic rapport with these new X-Men.
Can I just point out, we've mentioned this before, that Professor X is a bit of a douche throughout this run.
He is. And I'm glad they actually got rid of him, quite frankly. I mean, the thing is, he comes back, sure. But in 60 issues, Professor X only does one extraordinary thing. In the entire time. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, we need to get down to brass tacks and you go, it is because of Professor X that they contain Phoenix. He puts the psychic locks back in her head to bring back Phoenix back from the dark. And you go, other than that moment, except for there's that one flashback where he's in Cairo or whatever it is and he has that psychic, he really doesn't, he's ineffectual.
Because it's not about his generation anymore.
No.
You know, it's about... The all new, all different X-Men.
Yeah, and there's actually a wonderful line in it, I think it's right near the end. It's just before Days of Future Past, where basically Professor X finally says, he hands it over. He basically says, this is Scott, you're in charge.
Yeah.
You know, and he basically hands it over and of course Scott walks, which I think is great. But basically, you know, because Scott leaves and, you know, he has to hand it over to Storm. But I think that's a really amazing moment because it's where Professor X finally realizes that it isn't his X-Men anymore.
Yeah, and so from that, that's basically the first arc. And we get after the first few issues, we get the Phoenix saga. And we kind of start moving into some of the other big sagas here. Now, we get the Proteus saga. I don't think that comes immediately after, does it? There's a whole lot of stuff where they're in space.
Phoenix, and then we're crossing backwards and forwards a lot because what happens with the Phoenix saga, which I thought was really interesting, was basically they have a tussle with Magneto, and the tussle with Magneto leads to the X-Men being split up. Basically, Hank, who's come back, the Beast, has basically come back briefly, but he gets caught up with them, and him and Jean manage to escape this fiery death, so to speak. Because of this, Professor X thinks the other X-Men are dead, and he gets so shattered by this that he goes off to space with Lilandra. One of the Shi'ar. And she invites him away, and he basically goes off to space.
Shi'ar ruler, in fact. She rules the galaxy.
Well, not yet. She's going to become the princess. And then what... as actually happened is that the other X-Men actually did escape and they're now trying to make their way home. And this leads to a really interesting story arc because you've got them going from Antarctica to Japan to Canada.
Don't forget, via the Savage Land.
Via the Savage Land. And so we've got all of these adventures happening and not once did they think we could pick up a phone and call home.
No.
But, you know, so they're thought to be dead. But
they didn't have mobiles in those days.
That's true. But... so much for Xavier being the psychic extraordinaire as well, because you'd think if he'd be... anyway. So they're having this massive adventure. Meanwhile, Jean is trying to patch her life back together, thinking that Scott's died. Scott thinks she's died. So basically, we've got that. And that leads to the first stages of this really interesting relationship. Because Scott actually says he feels sad about Beast's death, but he feels nothing for Jean.
Yeah, that's right.
And as we go on, basically, it comes to a conclusion where he says... I felt so much for Jean that if I had allowed myself to feel grief, I would have died, basically. Because he literally shut himself down because he couldn't deal with the fact that she had died. And that is the beginnings of this epic romance that, you know, that is staggering, you know? And yes, the romance has started earlier than that, but this is where it really builds to this tragic event.
But she ends up on Muir Island at this point with Moira MacTaggert, doesn't she?
That's correct. So she's, she takes a trip out, because she's gone on a trip around Europe and stuff, which also establishes
Jason Wingard and the Hellfire Club.
And this is why we say this is so intricately bound. Because he starts to basically manipulate her. And this is long before Dark Phoenix.
Yes, and so you start getting this situation where you've got Jean on Muir Island having her powers tested and everyone's starting to worry that she's got this...
And she's not going to be able to control
it. Exactly. She's got this massive power and she keeps saying she's too young and she's too inexperienced.
Has she saved the universe by this stage? Yes, she has. She's saved the universe.
During their space adventures, which we've got to say involves things like the Starjammers and Corsair and all those sorts of people, things that would obviously set up Lynx and the X-Men years and years to come.
You know,
when you think about the X-Men in space being an 80s or 90s thing, it goes right back to
this.
If
we're a little all over the place here, guys, bear with us. It's 60 issues we're trying to summarize. So.
But during this time, you know, but also because it's several simultaneous storylines that all come together during the Dark Phoenix Days of Future Past stuff. You've got her working out her powers. You've got Moira MacTaggert hiding something on Muir Island, which is Mutant X, is all we know.
Yeah.
And those of you who have seen X-Men 2 know exactly where that's going. You've got this other team, as we said, trying to make their way back home, and ultimately they find them when they all end up together on Muir Island. That starts what's now known as the Proteus Saga, which, David, you were saying is one of the points where you...
Well, I got to say, 1980, I think it was, 1979, I think it was. Oh, actually, 70, yeah, I think it's early 79, the Proteus Saga was unleashed upon the world. And I was in England, and I picked up this comic book, and I had actually, at that point in my life, had never read the X-Men. And that was my first X-Men comic, and I was sold 100%. And it was like reading it this time around, when I hit that issue, I knew the cover, and as soon as I hit that issue, I went... Oh my God, I'm home.
we're talking about around the mid-120s, about 125, there's an issue called There's Something Awful on Muir Island. And this is the first appearance of Mutant X or Proteus. From this point onwards, I felt that way too. I felt suddenly these are my X-Men.
Yeah.
And I felt the story, as good as it was before that, as good as all the setup was, which you needed to get to that point, suddenly you were in this place where it's like, I'm comfortable. I know no matter what happens at this point, the X-Men are going to do their X thing.
Yeah.
And this is where we go. And this is where we start getting some really complex storytelling, because we've actually got a situation where it's revealed that Moira MacTaggert's son is Proteus and he's leaping from body to body.
And we also find out that she's married, which we've never known found out before. This point.
Still married because her abusive ex, or abusive, for her, for, as far as she's concerned, ex-husband.
Yeah.
But as far as the law's concerned, her current husband, who's rather conveniently removed by the end of the
saga. Which really upsets Banshee, of course, who we didn't mention previously. Banshee was actually an older character who came back on board.
That's true. He wasn't one of the new characters for this thing.
But no, he was one of the older ones. Yeah. But he immediately fell in love with Moira MacTaggert.
And by this stage, he's actually been injured, so we know he's not going to stick around forever. He's been injured and he's lost his powers, basically. Yeah. He's in love with Moira MacTaggert. She seems to be fond of him, but she's obviously got this dark secret that she can't let herself go with. Very long story short, Proteus jumps from person to person and really seems to kick the X-Men's ass during this period.
Because he has the ability to not only suck the life force out of people, but he can also bend reality.
Yes.
Which really disturbs Wolverine because of his senses. It basically really throws him for a loop.
But this is why the story becomes complex. If you already mentioned Jason Wingard and the Hellfire Club, Jean starts slipping in and out of time. And at first she thinks this is the result of Proteus's reality bending. But it turns out that Jason Wingard is actually slowly suggesting things to her that she has known him in a previous life, that she's always loved him. So these two stories are running
similar. Breaking down her boundaries.
That the only things holding Phoenix in place.
Yeah.
So these things are all happening simultaneously. So we feel something massive is building up. And this is one of the things I want to say about this book, is that all the classic stuff we've ever read, We've always said it's a product of its time. This is very much a product of its time. This is one of the few times I've read something where I thought, it's building to something. I can feel like I want to keep reading because I know something big's coming. Even when we read that massive Spider-Man run last year or the year before, we knew we were leading up to the death of Gwen Stacy, but we didn't necessarily care about what happened in between.
All the inter-issues between...
We're filler. Yeah.
Whereas this, everything is important. Yes. Every issue has something building to the superstructure of the story. And that, I think, is what put X-Men apart from everything else at the time. And this is why it went from a book that wasn't selling very well to being the X-Men of legend. I mean, this is why Claremont is basically a god of comic books, because he basically turned a nothing book into something that was, as he said in his interview, people lined up to get at the comic book store. It was like, we had to know what happened next.
Yeah, you know? Because before, this is, like we're thinking, before a time when direct comic book stores were a thing, you know, people would be either getting these through newsagent subscriptions or through newsstands and what have you. So this is amazing. But of course, this is all building up. The breaking down of Jean's mental barriers is building up to a point where Phoenix is unleashed and it becomes the dominant force within her. And she becomes, creatively, the Dark Phoenix.
Yes.
She moves from a green to a black costume.
Well, first, she becomes the Black Queen. Is that correct? Yeah, Black Queen.
She becomes
first.
The Black Queen with the Hellfire Club.
That's right.
First.
So the Hellfire. So we should before we get to Dark Phoenix, because there are two events I think that need to be talked about. First one is Peter Rasputin, Colossus, who was at the time the youngest X-Man, and he was also very pure, you know, farm boy, etc. And the Proteus saga actually made him take a life. And he was the one that actually finally brings Proteus down, because Proteus had a problem with metal and inorganic materials. And he basically punches his fists through Proteus to bring him down. And that really kind of disturbed him. Mm. Meanwhile, the Wingard stuff basically goes full throttle at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
And Jean is turned into the Hellfire Club's Black Queen.
Mm. Replacing Emma Frost.
Who is dispatched fairly early.
And I don't know when she returns to the comic. I'll actually have to do a little
bit. Yeah, we'll have a little bit of research on that. But
Don't worry, we'll return to the X-Men at some
stage. Yeah, we're coming back to this. But during the Hellfire Club, basically, the X-Men are imprisoned, and there's a whole subplot that goes along with that. A lot of that is interesting, but what the most important part of all that is it has completely broken down Jean's inhibitions at this point. So when she finally does regain her memory. And the last straw, of course, is the fact that Wingard shows her psychically Scott's death.
Yes.
And that basically snaps her back, but also breaks her down completely.
Mm.
And that leads us to Dark Phoenix.
Dark Phoenix is a character who, as Claremont says again in this interview we keep referencing, is a hard character to forgive once it's been unleashed, because she effectively devours a sun and destroys millions of lives.
5 billion people.
5 billion people. Billions of lives, in fact. And that's something, it's difficult for a character to come back from that.
Yeah, we actually addressed this in the interview, which was, you know, because Phoenix is a kick-ass character. I mean, Jean Grey never interested me as Marvel Girl. But Jean Grey as Phoenix was kick-ass. And the question posed to Chris Claremont was, did he ever consider just keeping her as a character because she is so good? Or was her death always inevitable? And he actually said that he didn't want her to die. It was actually the editors who said, you have to reconcile 5 billion deaths.
Yeah, I mean, look, the thing is, again, he references this in the comic about the fact that he elevated women, because women were in comics at the time really much, very much seen as girlfriends or hangers-on or not being able to handle that power. And he references
frails.
It's actually amazing. It was a very different time, because Wolverine and the likes are always referring to women as frails. Or
mostly
broads.
Wolverine, though, which kind of fit his character as well.
Yeah,
so I kind of forgave it from Wolverine, because everything was frails and bub.
Frails, bub, and broads.
Yeah.
I reckon that's going to be my unauthorized biography of Wolverine. yeah, snickety. Frails, bubs, and broads. The unauthorized biography of Wolverine. Yeah, look, it's... And I think that was the thing about Phoenix. She was, for a brief shining moment, the most powerful woman anywhere ever.
Yeah.
The most powerful person.
Yeah.
Anywhere, everywhere. And she was a woman. The fact that she couldn't handle the power that says a lot as well. But
then again, as we established later, much later, in fact, even the guys couldn't
handle No one can handle
Nobody can handle that power.
It's the Phoenix Force.
Yeah. Phoenix Force is unstoppable. So.
Yes. I mean, look, you know, this is an amazing run, and that is effectively the conclusion to an arc that had been building up over 40 issues. But Claremont doesn't waste any time before moving into something else. But before we move on to that...
Before we move on to that, though, I think it's very important to note something that I had forgotten. Now, I read this series in first run back in the early 80s, so it had a lot of impact back then. But something I had actually forgotten, which is that the Shi'ar Nation didn't kill Jean Grey, which is they actually condemn her to death and they put her on the moon and basically there's a challenge and there's a fight and blah, 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 that giant size issue. What is really interesting is she kills herself.
Mm.
And I think that's a really interesting point to make, is the fact that she knew that she couldn't control it. She knew that eventually it was going to come out again. And in fact, it does during the challenge. And so she very cleverly gets the X-Men to fight her, to wear her down, because she's still not at full power, so that she then has the strength to fire the weapon, which kills her.
Yes.
Because she knows that this is going to cause more problems. And I think that is probably part of the tragedy of all this. And she dies, basically, in Cyclops' arms.
Mm.
So it's a really powerful moment. And I think you needed that issue 138, I think it is.
Which is the funeral issue, effectively.
Yeah. The summary. You needed that, because that Phoenix issue was so potent that you sit there and you kind of sit back going, do I go on? You know, this is really hard stuff. This was all done during Comics Code, and you know, it's all and they managed to pull all this off.
This is a time when death in comics meant something.
Yeah, absolutely.
Again, something we talk about with Chris. But issue one after issue 138, which is this beautiful, as we've mentioned, bringing to a close at the end of an era, really, because it is the death of one of the original X-Men. And a real understanding of what Scott's all about, we get something new.
Interesting, before you go on, though, it's the death of one character and another character leaves.
Yes.
Because Scott also leaves the X-Men at this point. And so we basically, all of the old guard are gone.
And that's exactly it. But before we before we start into the next big saga, we're introduced in issue 139 to Kitty Pryde.
Yes.
Who is undoubtedly one of the most popular characters over the years. She eventually becomes Shadow Cat, but she is very green at this point. Issue 139 is a bit of a fun issue where it's kind of introducing her and how she comes into the team. Very much what that clip we played at the start is based on.
But what was she called at this point? Sprite.
Sprite, yeah, which I think was a bit of product placement, because I think Professor X is holding up a lemonade going, I think we should call her Sprite, because she's cool and refreshed. No. Yeah. and bubbly. But they introduced her, and then almost immediately, issue 140, there was another issue there with the Wendigo.
Which I actually was thinking about that just before we started recording the show. There's a line in that, which we actually kind of scoffed at when we were reading it. But there's a line after talking to Chris Claremont where it's almost like he's clarifying something. Claremont. with the Wendigo. When they bring the Wendigo down, he says, under Canadian law, he is responsible for the crimes he committed while he was the creature. Yeah. Phoenix was responsible for the crimes while she was Phoenix. Jean Grey was responsible.
That's true.
I think it's almost like he's clarifying why she had to die.
I think that's true, actually. And I think that's obviously something that was on, very much on his mind.
Yeah.
Probably having received some response at that stage, because that issue had been on shelves for a couple of months. Yeah. But then we almost immediately go into the shortest saga, but probably one of those powerful and long-lasting, so much so that they're making a film out of it this year. Days of Future Past, which we've tacked on in this show as a bit of a coda, but it's hard to not talk about it when you're talking about that run of comics. We could have started the next run, talked about Days of Future Past. And in fact, if we get back to talking about Chris Claremont, we should start with Days of Future Past. But this is a book that starts in the future, the far distant time of 2013, when mutants have basically been eradicated, and all superheroes, in fact.
Yeah, not just mutants, anybody with powers.
Powers by these giant sentinels who are very much a part of that 90s TV series. I always remember those being a huge part of it. Because Senator Kelly has been presidential hopeful. Senator Kelly was killed, and he was the mutant league, the anti-mutant leagues took this as an excuse to get a whole lot of things passed, where basically became martial law. Sentinels took over, and mutants and all superpowers are wiped off the face of the earth, and there's a small band of rebels. Almost everybody's dead except for, I think it's Wolverine.
It's Colossus, Storm, Wolverine.
And Kitty Pryde.
And Franklin Richards.
And Franklin Richards, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, they're all still alive in the future. Kitty is the only one who, during that time, had not built up any psychic guards or something, some, you know, flimsy excuse.
Yeah.
So they send her back in time to inhabit her younger body. And after a very quick convincing of the others that she is from the future, convinces them to go and save
Senator Kelly,
which they do. And there's a plot from the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, something that we talk about in the interview. Something that's always bugged David. If Magneto feels righteous, why would he call his group the Brotherhood of Evil
Mutants?
Wouldn't
it just be the Brotherhood of Mutants?
Anyways, he, for a group that's all about equality, White's Brotherhood, when there's clearly a lot of female members
that's
in there
true.
As well. So,
yeah.
Anywho. They,
personal niggle, people. You don't need to write in.
You know, very much a sidebar. We can spend a whole other issue on that one. But they fight them and defeat them and they save the day. But what is really interesting is it cuts back and forth between this reality. And that's what makes this story so fascinating and so enduring, and what they'll presumably do in the film, is that these two realities are running concurrently. And certainly they came back to that reality in the future comics, that did actually continue to exist somewhere.
To a level, because as the comics would continue on from that point, Sentinels do play a big part many times over.
And in fact, the future hasn't been killed, it's just been pushed back a bit, perhaps.
Yeah, because, I mean, we've seen the future that Cable comes from, for instance. You know, it's like, that's not a pretty sight.
But I think what's really interesting about that arc is that this is, as you said, we've seen the future and it's not pretty. This is a book about hope. This is a book about, you know, what the future of humanity
uniting
will look
mankind.
Like. Uniting mankind. And then we see the future and it's horrible.
Yeah.
And, you know, how can they go on fighting knowing that it could all fall apart so quickly?
And I think the moral of it all is that there is the possibility they can change that future. And they've seen one possible outcome. And that possible outcome is not desirable. And so they basically are fighting or striving constantly because they have seen what could be.
Exactly right.
And I think that's the basis of everything X-Men from that point onwards. And the X-Men, let's face it, over the last 40 years have seen absolute atrocities with House of M and everything else that has happened, and the mutants being wiped off the planet by Wanda, you know. And it's like, you sit there by the Scarlet Witch and you sit there and go, there are so many atrocities. The destruction of Genosha with the nuclear weapons and the super sentinels and all this. And you sit there and go, this is just, they are faced with tragedy after tragedy after tragedy, and yet the X-Men keep going. And I think that is the moral of it all, is that they are striving to try and change it.
Yes.
They're striving constantly to find that balance of Homo sapien and Homo superior.
Exactly.
And I think the first thing they need to do is stop calling themselves Homo superior, because that makes people very nervous, I think. It's an extraordinary, and I think this is why the X-Men have endured so long and have become really Marvel's Batman.
I agree. And look, and it really is an industry, because there are about 17 X titles every month. One thing I want to quickly mention, and I really shouldn't do this quickly, but we really have to give major props to people like Dave Cockrum, John Byrne, and Terry Austin and the likes on these books. The artists who brought these characters to life, from Chris Claremont and John Byrne's writing, their designs have endured as much as...
Well, John Byrne himself was actually a penciler as well.
He was a penciler. So, that's what I'm saying. Though it's very much a co-creation. Those have very much endured over the years, and I don't think we can sort of understate how important this run is to not just modern X-Men, but modern comics as well. Just the idea
Agreed.
Of things that can happen. And again, you'll hear the interview on our feed, but we need to thank Chris Claremont once again for his generous time for talking to us about this book.
I'd also like to thank Chris Claremont for writing this book.
Yes.
I mean, for giving us the X-Men as we know.
Let's face it, for getting us into comics in a lot of ways.
Yeah, many ways. I mean, let's say, I said this in the interview, his X-Men Proteus saga was what got me into comic books in 1979. So,
and, you know, every comic is someone's first comic, and if that's going to be one of your first comics, damn, you've lucked out.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Look, folks, that is it for another show.
That was fast.
You're very lucky, because we really have been recording for over 2 hours today, because we did another hour interview.
Yeah.
So you're lucky. It's a shorter show, but you get two shows this week. We might be taking a little break, just a short break after this. We may not be here next week or the week after. We're not quite sure because David's going away shortly.
Yeah, I have to go to Melbourne for a week, and I'm not sure where those weekends are going to cross over. It's a bit up in the air. We will keep you posted on the Facebook page once we have some dates locked down.
That'll determine what book we do next. We're not going to tell you what we're doing just now.
It'll be on the... Well, I think we had one book picked, though.
We did, but we couldn't do it.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
It
turned out to be unpublished.
Yes. So we're doing Behind the Panel. Just check out behindthepanels.net and also the facebook.com.
As soon as we know what the next book is, it'll go on the front page of Behind the Panels. And we're going to work out the next few books as well and put those onto the reading
list. But rest assured, towards the end of April, we'll also be doing an Iron Man 3 special.
Oh, yeah.
Because Iron Man 3 comes out in Australia a little bit earlier, so we'll be reviewing the film and we'll also be looking at the Prelude comics as well.
We'll also be taking a look at The Walking Dead as a special in the next couple of weeks. Mm. And in a couple of months, because they keep taking breaks, we'll probably be doing...
Probably towards the end of May, we'll do an Arrow special
as well. But yeah, there's all stuff to look forward to. So we've got a lot of stuff coming up.
But thank you for sticking with us for this shorter new look episode, and hopefully they'll all be about this length from now on, and hopefully sticking with us for 53 more episodes. So
And any other future interviews we have.
So. Which we've got a lot lined up. I've just confirmed a couple this morning. I'm very excited to share with you. So we'll tell you a bit more about those. Before you go as well, behindthepanels.net, we're still running a competition where you can win both volumes of The Deep, thanks to Madman and Gestalt Publishing. Head along there. That competition's open until April 17th, I think.
Right.
So check that out. Thank you once again for stopping by. We'll see you all next time.
See you then.